Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. I have been impressed for decades by the uncommon intelligence, the extraordinary productivity, and the great courage of our first guest. His name is Robert Spencer. He is no stranger to these microphones, needless to say. He is the author of dozens of books, including most recently one I'm proud to say, it's a product of the Center for Security Policy Press, entitled Islamophobia and the Threat to Free Speech. Robert is a senior fellow of the Center for Security Policy. He is also the director of an absolutely indispensable online resource, jihadwatch.org, a production of the David Horowitz Freedom Center. He is always a welcome guest here, especially today, on the occasion of a stunning news item that we wanted to get his take on. Robert Spencer, welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio.
Always good to talk to you, Frank. Thank you.
Well, the pleasure is truly mine. Let me ask you about this report that you feature in a post yesterday. It talks about an unbelievable ruling by a Texas judge. Her name is Andrea Thompson, concerning a woman's right to be divorced in the United States pursuant to U.S. law. What did Judge Thompson say about that matter?
Well, what is very strange about this case is that she ordered a Muslim woman who was wanting a divorce to go through arbitration, not through the ordinary arbitration channel, but through essentially a Sharia court. And this is because she had signed an Islamic prenuptial agreement saying that everything regarding the marriage would go through Sharia law. But now she said, this is Miriam Awad, who is trying to get the divorce, that she signed it under duress, actually didn't know what she was signing, was fooled, tricked into signing it. But the judge just brushed that aside, didn't take it into account at all, and said that she had to submit to the Sharia tribunal.
This is all the more extraordinary, given that you would think a female judge would be particularly attentive to the implications for a Muslim woman to have three men in an arbitration panel governed by Sharia law adjudicating this matter. Talk a little bit, Robert, for the uninitiated, about what that is likely to mean for this woman, and most especially for her rights in America under U.S. law, which is, after all, intended to be the supreme law of the land, our Constitution and what flows from it.
This is a complete trampling of her rights under U.S. law, because under Sharia, the man and the husband in this case has all the cards, has entire control. She can only get the divorce if he agrees, if the court agrees that it's justified. And that's on the basis of her testimony, which is devalued in relation to the testimony of her husband.
So she's only worth, what, half of the value of a man? Is that right?
That's right. And that's based on the Quran and is enshrined in Sharia. So she's got the cards stacked against her in the first place. There also are all the disquieting reports coming out of Britain's Sharia courts, where many, many times women who were subjected to domestic abuse were told by the Sharia courts to go back to their husbands and try to please him more fervently instead of being referred to the British courts for the violence. And this is because the Quran and Sharia allow for a man to beat disobedient women. Consequently, this is not a court in which Miriam Ayad has any reason to expect equal justice, not even remotely.
Yeah. Well, equal justice under American law, again, which is something to which she is entitled here. And Robert, I guess this makes the larger point, which you have documented so impressively in so many of your books, about the inherent character of Sharia. It is not adhered to by all Muslims, I think it must be said, but those who follow what is described by the authorities of the faith as the authoritative version of the faith are obliged to follow its dictates. And they are horrifically misogynistic, among other things. They're not so good for others, for that matter, but most especially for women. And it's just mind-boggling that an American jurist would see fit to do this. But in your piece, you remind us that there have been, and we've been involved in some of them, efforts to ensure that Sharia is not allowed to trump American law in state legislatures across the country. And some have adopted such legislation, some have not. But the importance of it is certainly underscored by this episode, is it not?
Yeah, absolutely. Because all those efforts, whether they were successful or not, were met with charges of Islamophobia. It was charged that Sharia was completely compatible with American constitutional law, with the idea of the equality of rights of all people before the law. And those who were pushing the anti-Sharia measures were accused of basic racism and bigotry and Islamophobia. They didn't want Sharia in the country just because they disliked Muslims, and they disliked Muslims just because Muslims were brown and they were racist. That was the line. And it went all over the country. It was trumpeted by the establishment media for years. Now we're seeing, in the case of Maryam Ayad, and there will be many others after this, that Sharia really is not compatible with American law. It disadvantages women in numerous ways. And this is an American citizen. She deserves her rights under American law, and her case ought to be adjudicated solely by American law. And this indicates the danger that bringing Sharia into American courts poses for women and for others.
Yeah. Well, I pray that she is successful in her appeal, and heaven help this country if she's not, because there will be a lot more of this here, as you say, not just in Britain and elsewhere, but here. Robert, let me turn to another example of apparently misogyny on a rather significant scale inside an organization that both of us have decried for many years. Both of us have been, of course, attacked by relentlessly, but that I think is now being exposed by one of its own employees, a former employee, namely the Council on American Islamic Relations. Remind us what this group is, first off, and what's the latest evidence that behind the curtain, as you describe it, is a deeply, deeply problematic outfit.
Well, Frank, the Council on American Islamic Relations, or CAIR, is, of course, the organization, the main Muslim organization in the United States, the one that gets most of the attention. It's the media's go-to organization when they need a Muslim to comment on whatever news item is at hand. They claim to be the nation's largest Muslim civil rights organization, but have demonstrable links verified by the Justice Department itself to Hamas and to the Muslim Brotherhood.
A designated terrorist organization in the first instance, and one that should be designated here as such an organization, right?
Precisely. And the Muslim Brotherhood, of course, according to the infamous captured internal documents that the Center for Security Policy has done such important work to expose, is dedicated, in its own words, to eliminating and destroying Western civilization from within and sabotaging its miserable house. When you look at CAIR's record, it seems very clear that that's what they're up to, because everything they do seems to be designed to foster division in American society, to weaken the cohesiveness of American society, to weaken counterterror efforts, and so on. I couldn't think of a better way to sabotage the miserable house of Western civilization than what CAIR has been doing for over two decades now.
Insidiously inside the wire, especially under the Obama administration, and I think this one. Just very quickly, this employee, former employee now, Lori Soroya, has been sued by CAIR for defamation. And evidently, what she is the kind of information about the culture of misogyny, as she calls it, and dishonesty and misleading donors and a host of other things, including efforts to silence its critics that are, as I say, very, very troubling. Robert, we're going to have you back on to talk about this further and much more in the very near future, if we may. But thank you for your time today and for all the great work you do, and including this brilliant new pre-publication success of your updated version of Did Muhammad Exist? Congratulations on it rising, I gather, to the number one rank, even before it's available. And we look forward to talking with you about that when it is. Thank you so much for joining us today. Come back to us again soon, if you would. Next up, we'll speak with former Assistant Secretary of State Robert Destro about jihad in Nigeria, what it will mean for all of us right after this.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back, and I can't tell you how pleased I am to have with us our next guest. His name is Robert Destro. He has been a champion of human rights and a real freedom fighter for them for decades, notably as a professor of law at the Columbus School of Law at Catholic University, where he is these days, but also for a time in the Trump administration as the Assistant Secretary of State for Democracy, Human Rights, and Labor. And in that capacity, he found himself confronting, well, I guess you'd call it the swamp. The deep state, by some counts, but certainly the entrenched bureaucracy, including that of the Foreign Service, with respect, among other things, I think, to especially a country that is in deep crisis, namely Nigeria, the most populous nation in Africa and an ally of our own country. I was very pleased to see a report in the Epoch Times recently about remarks that Robert Destro made at an event sponsored by friends of ours at the International Committee on Nigeria, also known as ICON, on, I believe it was the 12th of June, which was Democracy Day in Nigeria. And he held forth and described not only with great clarity and I think accuracy what is happening on the ground in Nigeria and the difficulties he'd had while a senior official at the State Department getting the rest of the government, certainly his own department, to recognize that reality and respond appropriately. And so to talk about all of that, Mr. Secretary, it's great to have you with us. Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio.
Well, thanks for having me this morning.
I want to visit with you a bit about the two parts of this, as I just set it up. Let's talk first about what is actually happening on the ground in this vast and strategically, critically important energy-producing and, as I say, very populous state in Africa.
Well, I mean, let's begin just with a little bit of geography. I mean, Nigeria is the largest country in Africa. It's very, very deeply populated. It's divided, ethnically and religiously. I think if most of your listeners were to, you know, put Africa to the side for a minute and they think about Europe, everybody understands, that Europe is ethnically and linguistically divided. But somehow when we, you know, transpose it back to pack over to Africa, people forget that there are ethnic and linguistic and religious divides within Africa that are second nature to us when we talk about Europe, but seem to be opaque to us when we talk about Africa.
So, and that matters because those fault lines have in the past created conditions that have been, well, exploited, I guess you might say, translated into truly horrific genocidal mass murder And that may be what we're looking at in Nigeria today, is it not?
Well, it is, but I don't want to just focus on that part. It's kind of how do we unless we understand what a problem looks like, we can't really try and figure out what to do about it. And of course, there's very little in some respects that the United States can do in such a big country like that. But we can have a rational policy, which I don't think we have at this point. You know, but let's look at it this way, that the North has historically been, divided ethnically and was at one time, before the British got there, a Muslim kingdom. The South is where all the Christians live, and the Middle Belt is where the two cultures come together. Then you have to overlay a huge ethnic and linguistic map on top of that. And so as we look today, at the carnage, I mean, the mass killings, the big, the kidnapping. We had a couple of years ago, of course, we had the schoolgirls. We had a bunch of school kids kidnapped, Christian school kids kidnapped in Kaduna State just this week. And we said, what's driving this? How do we understand it? And part of it is an ethnic, the ethnic Fulanis, want to take over the whole country. And they have been wanting to do that since the 1800s. And so if we were to say what's the nearest analogy if we were to put it in Europe, it would be one ethnic group invading somebody else's space and trying to take it over. That's what we've got going on, and that's where a lot of the killing is coming from.
So, Robert Destro, you've introduced one of the principal groups. It's not, of course, just in Nigeria that the Fulanis are rampaging. It's true in other neighboring countries in the so-called Lake Chad region as well. But one thing that you sort of alluded to there is that they are overwhelmingly Muslim, this tribe, and they're not just groups like Boko Haram and, the Islamic State of West Africa, but they are in the government of Nigeria as well, are they not? And how does that translate into policies of the government towards the kind of carnage and rampaging and kidnapping and the like that you've talked about?
Well, the first step would be to just recognize that the Fulani are one of many ethnic groups in Africa, and in Nigeria. But they, because they are an ethnic group and because the lines in West Africa were not drawn by themselves, these ethnic groups cross over international boundaries in West Africa. And so the question, where did the Fulani live, requires you to take a look at an ethnic map of West Africa. We have the Yoruba and the Igbo. There's lots of different ethnic groups and lots of different linguistic groups. And so if you talk to Nigerians, what they'll tell you is that the current government is dominated by the Fulani ethnic group, and they're playing favorites, and they're discriminating against their fellow Nigerians. And in kind of an interesting way, President Buhari has invited the Fulani to come into Nigeria, basically setting it up. So he's got a lot of in-migration, and these people have got to go settle somewhere. And they're basically expanding across into the ethnic regions of other groups.
Yeah.
And this causes tension.
But here's the quicker. Sorry, go ahead.
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Finish your thought.
Yeah, what I was going to say, and then you have to layer the Islamic Christian thing on top of that. And that has to be looked at in a broader sense. It's not just the Fulani. I mean, what we've got is a major superhighway for ISIS and Al Qaeda that goes from the Red Sea, basically the Persian Gulf, all the way down to West Africa. So you have a huge ISIS superhighway. All those folks from Syria are heading down into West Africa. That's the flashpoint.
Well, that's what I really wanted to get at with you, Mr. Secretary, is the fact that those Islamic State types, these, I call them Sharia supremacists, as we were talking about with Robert Spencer a moment ago, are on the march, seeking to carve out in Africa, notably but not exclusively in Nigeria, it seems, a new caliphate that would be vastly larger, its geography, as well as in terms of its power, if they were able to obtain control of the resources, not just energy, but minerals and diamonds and all kinds of other things, that particular nation and in the region. So the question that I guess arises is, where is our government on this? As you say, we can't necessarily control things there, but talk a little bit about your experiences, given the clarity that you've just brought to the description of what's happening on the ground. Why do we continue to hear out of the State Department and our embassy and so on, well, this is really just a farmer-herder conflict, and it has nothing to do with these ethnicities, let alone with, you know, jihad against Christians?
Well, I think the first thing is that Americans generally, and I think the State Department is a microcosm, don't really get culture. We don't really understand ethnicity, and we're so heavily focused for historical reasons on race that even, you know, the difference between a Mexican and a Puerto Rican is they lump people all into a racial category. You know, but the important piece here is that the people within the State Department don't talk to each other. So you have the military people, you have the cultural people, you have refugees, and there's no one sense of, okay, what does a good relationship with Nigeria look like? What does a good outcome look like? We don't have those discussions. What we'll have is somebody say to you, oh, there's battles between farmers who are predominantly Christian, and then you have the Fulani tribesmen coming in and taking over their property and massacring people. And they say, oh, that's a farmer herder, and it's driven by climate change. Well, you know, setting aside the climate change discussion, it's only one piece of a huge puzzle. And you know, and so...
And they're leaving out some of the important pieces of that puzzle, I think it's fair to say.
Oh, I would say most of them.
Yeah. Just talk a little bit, we've only got a minute or two left, but about your experiences trying to contend with this, trying to forge a sensible policy towards one of the most important countries, arguably the most important country in Africa, which is unraveling before our eyes at an accelerating pace, it seems, with horrific consequences, especially for those Christians in the Middle Belt and South.
Well, it's not just that. I mean, there are horrific consequences for us and for Europe, because if the people of West Africa start to go on the move like the Syrians did, they're all going to Western Europe. I mean, that this is a...
And on to us in due course. Yeah, no doubt about that.
Yeah, I mean, we're looking at huge destabilization, and there's no bones being made by President Buhari and many of the other Fulani leaders that they want to reestablish the caliphate that they had back in the 1800s. So, I mean, a little dose of history.
Yeah, is so vital. And sadly, we are out of time for today. I hope that you will come back to us and talk a bit more about what we should be doing instead of turning a blind eye to all of this and thereby, I'm afraid, enabling it, certainly emboldening those who are perpetrating it. But thank you for your time in government, as well as for the great work you do on the outside and have for many years now at Catholic University once again. Come back to us with updates, if you would, on all of this as soon as we can arrange it. But thank you again for your time today. Next up, we'll speak with Natalie Witters of the National Pulse, fantastic young investigative reporter on China, among other things, right after this.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
We're back, and I couldn't be more pleased to say we are joined by one of the people who I have been most impressed by in the past year, particularly because of the work she does as an investigative reporter with a new organization, the National Pulse, headed up by Rahim Kassam, tremendous writer and reporter in his own right. And Natalie Winters is a force multiplier for not just the National Pulse and for its podcast, which she co-hosts with Rahim at thenationalpulse.com, but also for the cause, because she writes brilliantly. She is fearless in terms of the challenge of overcoming impediments thrown her way as she tries to follow a story, and she gets the facts right and she gets them out. And I'm deeply grateful, as well as I know our audience and I think the American people more generally, for all you do. Natalie Winters, at the tender age of 20, no less, you are a phenomenon as well as a wunderkind. So thank you for joining us to talk a little bit about some of your really important work. And we're delighted to have you with us.
Thank you so much for having me and for those kind words.
Well, they're heartfelt and, more to the point, they're warranted. Let me ask you about how you perceive the threat posed to our country by the Chinese Communist Party.
Well, I think as we're reflecting on the 100-year anniversary of the Chinese Communist Party, there's a lot of discussion about how the West endeavored to set out to change China. But in reality, and I think that this is, you know, consensus now, the Chinese Communist Party changed us, but more precisely, they changed the American elite, the American establishment. And of course, I could talk about the ideological compromise, which we see through really the Marxist subversion of so many elements of American society, whether it's critical race theory in the classrooms, all the way up to the military. But I also think, and this is what we really focus on at the National Pulse, is how so much of this subversion hasn't necessarily come through ideological compromise, but it's come in conjunction with what I call kind of a boots on the ground compromise, in the sense that people who hold positions of power, whether it be in the federal government and mainstream media and cultural institutions, they have such deep and extensive ties to the Chinese Communist Party, whether through financial deals, or just even to ideological compromise, or just even organizations that will, you know, court individuals with free trips to China, and upon return, they're forced to provide them with something in return. That's what we really focus on at the National Pulse. And I think that that is the most dangerous aspect of the Chinese Communist Party, not only because it's on full display in the Biden regime, but also because the Chinese Communist Party loves to target voices and institutions that Americans should revere and should respect and should really listen to. But they love to kind of alter and neuter what they're saying to be in line with propaganda and talking points of Beijing. Yet the Americans who are peddling this disinformation, they never really disclose that the reason why the narratives that they're pushing have such close alignment with the Chinese Communist Party is because they are so deeply tied to them. So it really is, not to use a phrase from the left, but this really is true disinformation, true misinformation, and it's propaganda. I don't think that is an overstatement.
No, I don't either. And it is, as you say, part and parcel of a comprehensive political warfare strategy that involves influence operations in all of our institutions. And I wanted to talk to you about one you alluded to a moment ago, namely the Biden regime, as you call it. The Biden administration, the Biden-Harris administration, we talked in the course of the program about polling that indicates most Americans don't think Biden is actually in charge of this administration, so who knows what we should call it. But whatever we do, it has been deeply compromised as well, from the president on down, let's face it, by the cumulative effects of years, in many cases, of Chinese influence operations and corruption and suborning in other ways. I wanted you to talk about that generally, because you've been doing a fabulous job documenting examples of it, notably with CIA Director Bill Burns, but also a chap by the name of Thomas Zimmerman. And his name came up again last night on Steve Bannon's show, which you frequent, the War Room, also co-hosted by your boss, Rahim. Two of our colleagues at the Committee on the Present Danger China, Sam Faddis and Trevor Loudon, were featured in a discussion of what is called the Accountability Initiative, which is kind of a parallel effort to your own, Natalie Winters. And I just wanted you to talk about Zimmerman in particular, just as an example of this problem and what it ominously portends for this administration and for our country.
Sure. Well, the Biden regime is most definitely radioactive with regards to the Chinese Communist Party influence over it. And Thomas Zimmerman, as you say, is really just one of many, many, many examples of a running and, trust me, ever-expanding list of people who have explicit ties, and not just to the Chinese Communist Party, but to front groups for the Chinese Communist Party that have direct links to whether it's espionage campaigns or groups whose sole purpose and effort is to get useful idiot type Americans to push the policies and agenda of the Chinese Communist Party in Washington. And I really think that there's no better example of this than, as you say, Thomas Zimmerman. And particularly, I think he's really an interesting character to focus on right now, because his role as a special assistant to Joe Biden on National Security Agency personnel really dovetails with what we're seeing going on with regards to Tucker Carlson and his allegations that the NSA had tapped his phone and had been reading his communications. And really, that's a concern of all Americans, which I would say is really when you see the U.S. federal government acting really in line with the Chinese Communist Party. But Thomas Zimmerman, to speak rather bluntly, really is an alum of a Chinese Communist Party-run think tank in Shanghai that has seen other Americans who've gone through this institution actually be arrested for selling classified documents from the CIA and other federal government agencies within the U.S. to this think tank, so they could then use that information to better target and really better weaken the United States before he joined the Biden regime, which I'd also add he served on the transition team. So he's been in there since before day one of the Biden regime. He's been playing a critical role in determining what is called the Office of Presidential Personnel. It's really the equivalent of HR in the White House in hiring processes, determining, you know, who gets to work where. And I believe it was Reagan who said, you know, personnel is policy. So, of course, within the Biden regime, you're going to get Chinese Communist Party personnel. And as a result, you're going to get Chinese Communist Party policy. And I really think that Thomas Zimmerman's key role in the personnel selection process of the Biden regime is on full display when you read a lot of the stories that we have up at the National Pulse, whether it's the Deputy Secretary of State, Wendy Sherman, who's taken free trips to China from influence groups that are backed by the Chinese Communist Party, whether it's his presumptive pick for China Ambassador Nick Burns, who used to consult alongside former Chinese Communist Party officials at a cushy DC-based consulting firm, or even if it's people who've spoken alongside researchers from MIT who've been indicted for actually conducting work on behalf of the Chinese government while taking American taxpayer dollars, who are now running Joe Biden's National Economic Council, all the way down to, you know, his China policy coordinator has also taken those trips to China from entities that want favorable coverage in return. And you can actually see through emails that we accessed of hers through WikiLeaks with John Podesta, this individual by the name of Melanie Hart says that she is, quote, fine with the Chinese Communist Party's international influencing over think tanks. So that kind of tells you the mindset that we're getting. And believe me, the Chinese Communist Party is not a silent investor on Wall Street and these think tanks and these academia institutions. They most definitely want, and believe me, get a high return on investment with the money that they're plowing into these institutions.
So institutions and individuals, you're absolutely right. Boy, there's so much there to unpack, and we're going to have to do it on another occasion. But let me just say, one data point that you had in your article about Thomas Zimmerman that really jumped out at me was that think tank that he'd been associated with was identified not just as having, you know, facilitated the transfer of classified information illicitly obtained from, you know, American traders, but they work for the Ministry of State Security of China. This is a relationship with, indeed, the intelligence services of the Chinese Communist Party, and it's therefore that much more scandalous, as is the fact that the director of the Central Intelligence Agency, as you've written about, Natalie Winters, in National Pulse, lied to the Senate Intelligence Committee during his confirmation hearings about his involvement with some of these kinds of Chinese influence operations. In fact, very directly, helping them under his tenure as the president of the Carnegie Endowment. So much more to talk about on that, but let me turn quickly to one other thing that you've done incredibly important work on, just very quickly. Describe the role of Peter Daszak and Tony Fauci with respect to enabling this Chinese Wuhan Institute of Virology. I've got less than a minute, so message discipline.
Sure. Well, I call COVID-19 the weapon of mass destruction from the Chinese Communist Party, and Peter Daszak the weapon of mass distraction. He's been really the key driver of propaganda on the origins of COVID-19, always in line with the Chinese Communist Party. And Fauci, whether he's on a mainstream media outlet, Chinese state-run media outlets, or sitting in front of senators, he can consistently lie. I encourage people to check out a report that we've up at the National Pulse about how Fauci, really for decades, has been pursuing collaboration with the Chinese Communist Party, even entities that are linked to the military. And the same goes for Peter Daszak and EcoHealth.
Dissembled about it in both cases. Natalie Winters, we have to leave it at that. Thank you for the work you do at the National Pulse, the National Pulse podcast, at the War Room Pandemic, and here. Come back to us again soon, if you would.
Thank you so much for having me.
Next up, we will be speaking with Robert Cahilly about the poll that finds most Americans don't think Joe Biden is actually in charge. That and more straight ahead. This is Frank Gaffney with the Secure Freedom Minute. A recent poll found that a majority of Americans believe Joe Biden is not in charge. His remarks yesterday about the end next month of U.S. military operations in Afghanistan reinforced that realistic perception. Notably, the apparent commander-in-chief in name only assured us the Taliban is highly unlikely to own the whole country. He said there's no circumstance in which helicopters will lift desperate people from the U.S. embassy roof like when we abandoned and lost South Vietnam. Only someone utterly disconnected from reality and responsibility could make such statements, let alone insist that the U.S. will continue to support the Afghan military and the people of Afghanistan will decide their country's fate. What will the person who is actually running America do when these preposterous assertions prove wrong, especially to protect us from a triumphant Taliban and embolden global jihad movement? This is Frank Gaffney. We're back, and I want to say a special welcome to our next guest. His name is Robert Cahilly. I have been admiring from afar for quite some time the work that he does at the Trafalgar Group. It has established itself as one of the most accurate and, I think, informative polling outfits in America, based in Atlanta, Georgia. He is its senior strategist and pollster. He has quite bravely gone where no pollsters might go in a number of his predictions based on his polling, in particular in the election space. But of particular interest is a poll that he released earlier this week concerning the public appreciation, a majority of the American people, in fact, that Joe Biden is actually not running the United States of America at the moment. We wanted to talk with him about that finding and what it suggests about both public attitudes and the condition of our country. I'm delighted to have Robert Cahilly with us to do that. Welcome, sir. Glad to have you.
Yes, sir. It's an honor to be on the show. And we really appreciate the chance to kind of talk about what we've been up to and this most recent poll. I tell you, one of the things that kind of confounds a lot of people is this. We had this kind of feeling in quite some time about a president, probably there, certainly not in the modern polling sense.
I think probably Woodrow Wilson, maybe, but it's been a long time. So this is interesting in a number of respects, Robert. Talk a little bit about the breakdown, the tabs, cross tabs, as they are called, I guess, in the trade. This is not uniquely a Republican perception, is that right?
No, absolutely. We did break it down by those. You had 56.5% of the public believe that he was not driving his policy and agenda, and that the most fascinating number is that the when you look at it by the partisan breakdown, that included a number of Democrats who did not think he was in charge, and that percentage was 31.7. So I mean, that's his own party, and you know, that's just nearly a third of his own party. Certainly, independents. There was the number that did not think he was in charge of 58.4. And among Republicans, it was 83.6.
So if there is really a majority of the American people who think that not only the president of the United States, but of course he wears the hat as well as commander-in-chief of our military, is not in charge, are there any insights into whether this is a satisfactory state of affairs as far as the American people are concerned?
Well, and let me clarify the difference between being in charge and being the one directing policy and agenda. I mean, they're not completely interchangeable. No one is doubting that he maintains the role as commander in chief. It's just when he makes a decision, is it something that he really wants, or is it something that someone is telling him this is what you should do? And I think that is of great concern. I think there are a lot of people who are very concerned because we talk about democracy. Well, part of that is the belief that the people that are making the ultimate decisions are accountable to the public. And so when there is this perception that somewhere there is a curtain and behind that curtain is someone calling the shots or a group of people calling the shots, people do get concerned.
Well, these terms, I think, are probably more interchangeable in at least the public's mind. And I must tell you, if somebody is doing what he's told rather than actually leading the country, that suggests he's not actually in charge and is very worrying to me personally. And Robert, I talked a bit about this in my commentary today. As I was listening to Joe Biden yesterday talking about Afghanistan, which is a major national security policy issue, he sounded like a man who was actually disconnected from reality. Now, I mean, it's not the first time that we've had presidents, or for that matter, other leaders, kind of whistling past the graveyard, if you will, when they have to deal with some pretty unpalatable choices and for that matter, decisions. But when he talked about the idea that the Taliban is not going to overrun the place, essentially ruling that out, and that there won't be a scene like we saw in Vietnam with people being lifted off the roof in desperate straits by helicopters at the last moments before the place is overrun. I mean, I think those are so clearly in prospect now that it raises a concern that he is not only not, well, in charge, but is really not entirely competent to be in charge, even if the arrangements were otherwise. So if that's, let's just for the purpose of discussion, postulate that that's the case, who do the people of the United States think actually is running the country? Do you have any insights into that?
Well, here's the good news. We are actually going to be polling that question in the next couple of weeks, and we're going to have some information on that. Now, I tell you, one of the things that seems striking that seems to be a problem, every president is very dependent upon the advice of multiple advisors, you know, quite often who disagree. I think the fear that we've run into, and that we, when we actually talk further to people, is not that there are people who are telling the president what he wants to hear. That's been the case since we've had presidents. But that
it's an occupational hazard.
Absolutely, but that he is not, you know, and when that happens in every presidency, there's, you know, different sides pushing back, and there's this kind of battle of ideas. The president says, "All right, I've heard all perspectives. Now I'm deciding this." What the fear is that battle of perspectives is happening before it gets to him, and he's being given one option because they've already had that.
Yeah. You know, I have the feeling, and I this is all now subjective rather than quantitative analysis based on your detailed polling, but I'm sure you can make an informed comment on the basis of that data, that the public is responding to the perception of Biden at the podium or in various settings, and the seeming, well, geriatric challenges that he's facing, and this is not a criticism. This is just, you know, acknowledging a reality about the human condition, isn't it? But when the public, you know, has this perception, do you sense that there is a concern more generically, if I can use that expression, about the state of the country, the state of our leadership more broadly, rather than just a question of he's not in charge and we don't know who is, and where is the accountability that we're supposed to have under our system of government? Is it a broader concern, do you think, that that is really being felt? Is that something you're also going to be testing in the next poll?
Yes. Well, first of all, it is a broader concern, and I think it also explains one of the phenomena we've been seeing, and that is, you know, you see with Biden an approval rating that is usually over 50%, or certainly is more positive than negative. And I don't actually disagree with it. We found the same thing. What we find is a disconnect between whether people approve of what the federal government is doing and whether they approve of Biden, in the sense that people who don't like what the government's doing don't dislike him personally, that his approval rating is very much whether people like him personally. And they can, many people who give him a positive approval rating also say they don't think he's in charge. So they don't actually hold him accountable because they don't believe he's in charge. And that phenomenon is very interesting.
They don't like what's happening, but it's not his fault, is what you're saying, because
he's
not in
charge. It's very much the inverse of Trump, where there are people that so many more people like his administration and the agenda more than they liked him personally, that there was a gap there. It's the inverse gap. And what's concerning about that is that there's going to be a reckoning, because when you have that separation, at some point people are going to vote based on that. And one of the things I've said routinely, and I think is responsible for most of this, is he ran as a centrist. He ran as a person who could be very empathetic, and he still seems to be that person who is empathetic, but the centrist policies do not seem to be the way he's governing. And that's where the disconnect is. When people voted for this with who they perceived to be a middle of the road Democrat in that multiple candidate primary, he came across as a centrist, a middle of the road Democrat. That's what people voted for. That's not what they think they got.
And Robert, again, I don't know whether this is something that your body of polling work supports, but are you saying that you sense the majority of the American people are unhappy about the direction the country is taking at the moment under, well, President Biden, whether he's in charge of it or...
Absolutely. And I'll give you three main areas where people seem to be giving us the most feedback. They're very frustrated about the border. They are very frustrated about the lingering effects of COVID, whether that is pushing young people to be vaccinated, to go back to school outside of their parents' input, whether that is threats of new lockdowns for the Delta variant, or even as it relates to ongoing push for people to be vaccinated who have had the opportunity and chosen not to. I mean, America is very much a place where what our numbers show is people consider the pandemic to be completed, to be over, when everyone's had a chance to have the vaccine, and people believe we're there.
Fascinating. Robert Cahaly, we have to leave it at that for the moment. This is a first of many conversations with you. This has been incredibly informative and illuminating and worrying about the state of our government and public attitudes about it. And we'll look forward to hearing about your next poll on the subject very much with great expectation. Thank you for joining us today and for the work you do as the senior strategist and pollster of a terrific polling organization, the Trafalgar Group. Come back to us again soon if you would, sir. I hope the rest of you will do it again Monday, same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.